Well then, brethren, greetings on another Sabbath day. Good morning to those of you across in the USA, in North America, and of course good afternoon to those of us over here in England. Today I'm going to begin a new series going through the book of Exodus. It's a few months ago we went through the book of Genesis, the entire book of Genesis, and we'll do something similar now with Exodus, which will not be a sort of full-blown verse-by-verse analysis. What we'll strive to do is to read through the entire book of Exodus, all the way through to chapter 40, and we'll pause here and there to add a bit of insight where we can. And this is a very good time of the year, I think, to go into Exodus. It's only a few weeks from now we come to Passover and the days of unleavened bread, and of course, that's when the main events of Exodus took place, in the early springtime, leading up to the escape of Israel from Egypt. So it's the best time of year, probably, to look through these events. It's, of course, an incident-packed, the book of Exodus. We've got Moses being called. We've got the 10 plagues, which brought Egypt down to its knees. We've got the escape of Israel going through the Red Sea, the giving of the Ten Commandments and so on. There's an awful lot of activity takes place at this time of the year. And as we go through Exodus, we can also look for some parallels in our own personal lives. I mean, here you've got ancient Israel in slavery, in Egypt, under the power of the Pharaoh. And here we are in our lives, in this worldly system, enslaved to the world standards, and of course we are redeemed and set free by Jesus Christ, our Passover, from the power of Satan over us. So there are some very close parallels. And just as Israel, of course, went through the wilderness on their way eventually to the promised land, their promised kingdom, so you and I today are going through a wilderness spiritually on our way to the promised land, the kingdom of God. So there's much that we'll find of great relevance to ourselves. And also, we can probably remember the words of the Apostle Paul, who said, "These things were written down for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." And he was talking particularly about the events surrounding Israel's escape from Egypt. So that's what we're going to do. We'll start, not surprisingly, in chapter 1 of Exodus and verse 1. "Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob." And we'll remember that by this time Joseph was already the prime minister in charge of the whole Egyptian empire, a very mighty and powerful and respected man. And of course latterly, Jacob, now an old man, comes down to Egypt with the rest of his family. Verse 2, "Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher." So these are the other sons of Jacob, the brothers of Joseph. "All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already," of course, as prime minister. And then, of course, time passes. And this is a very sort of brief resume of what had taken place. "And Joseph died, all his brothers, and all that generation." So many decades, many scores of years have passed. "But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." Now that would be the land of Goshen, which the Pharaoh had given to them. So, you know, they were a prolific people. They had quite big families, and as the decades and scores of years and centuries passed, you know, they grew and multiplied, ultimately coming to number, you know, several million. Verse 8, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." There's a change here in the politics of ancient Egypt. it says a new king arose. The implication there is it was a new dynasty, a new dynasty. The one particular line who had known Joseph and the history and so on had been removed. And along comes a brand new dynasty, a new king, who knew nothing of the past and probably wasn't interested in the history of the past. And it says the king arose. Again, the implication there is that probably arose almost by a sort of a coup d'etat, stood up in place of the previous dynasty. We don't know very much more than that, other than that there's now a dramatic change. The new ruler, the most powerful person in Egypt, whose word was law, had no regard at all for what had happened a few scores of years earlier. Verse 9, and he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. You know, the Israelites were numbering into the millions. And he's saying, I perceive here this could be dangerous for us. Verse 10, come, let us deal wisely or shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. So he's making a case here saying that, you know, if we get attacked by some other armies, some other nation, oh, you can't trust these Israelites. They may well side with that other nation against us. Verse 11. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. So they started to oppress and treat the Israelites rather harshly. Of course, that's happened particularly against the Jews for many centuries. They've very often come under very hard policies in various countries across Europe and Russia and so on. And, of course, the Holocaust was only a few decades ago. But this is Israel itself, and suddenly they're now being oppressed, treated very badly. Life is being made very difficult for them. They're now being constricted, enslaved virtually, and, amongst other things, being required to build these big supply cities, these treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. And that would have taken, no doubt, a number of years. Verse 12, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they, the Egyptians, were in dread of the children of Israel. It was unnecessary, of course, but you know, once you sort of see things and perceive things and your imagination starts to run riot, so the Egyptians were now getting very like paranoid about the Israelites. They're still multiplying. No matter how hard we treat them, there's more and more of them. And so they're getting quite nervous. Verse 13. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, with harshness, made life even more difficult, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Now, you know, I don't think any of us would really have wanted to have been there at this time. You know, you've been previously enjoying life in this country. You've been looking after your flocks and herds. You're largely of a sort of shepherd-type nation. You've enjoyed a number of years when you were highly respected because of Joseph. And now, in the course of a few years, you're virtually enslaved. And your life is being made absolutely miserable, having to get up early in the morning, having to work all through the day into the, you know, nighttime hours, perhaps. Perhaps being forced to work 7 days a week. You know, life really pretty tough for these people. But despite that, and much to the dismay of the Egyptians, they kept on multiplying. Verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of the one was Shipra, and the name of the other Pua, and he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, it's a boy, then you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. Which sounds like pretty horrific. Now, I suspect there were more than just two midwives looking after all the millions of Israelites. Some people reckon that probably between 500 and 1,000 midwives in total. And these two ladies, Shipra and Pua, were perhaps the leaders, the elders among the midwives, and were summoned to be given these instructions from the Pharaoh, basically saying, look, any boys who are born, you need to kill them. You know, just get a big stone and bash their brains in. You know, that's what would be like compulsory abortion. But the midwives were 17, feared God, and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive, which you would hope they would do, and they did do it, but obviously they would have realized that they were putting themselves into danger. The Pharaoh, you know, was quite a cruel taskmaster. He'd made their lives pretty miserable already, and they knew that if he found out they were disobeying his command, which was law, then they would have realized that they themselves could lose their lives. But, you know, they recognized what was right from what was wrong, and they preferred to do what was right and probably trust that God would watch over them and protect them rather than giving in to the commands of this rather hard man. And, of course, for you and me, very often in our lives we'll find people in power, in positions of influence, telling us to do things that we know are wrong. And we can remember these ladies, you know, they're named there for the whole world to see, Shipra and Pua. They did what was right. They were willing, really, to risk their lives to do right, to do what was good. And of course, for you and I, we have the same choice very often. Who do we obey, man or God? Verse 18. And the king obviously spotted that something was not working here. Still as many being born as ever, and still as many young boys running around. What's gone wrong? Verse 18. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? There's boys everywhere. And the midwives said to Pharaoh, well, because Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they, that's the Hebrew women, are lively and strong and vigorous and give birth before us midwives even come to them. Which might have been, you know, sort of true, but might have been equally rather an exaggeration. And he's saying, well, basically, you Egyptian women are so weak and out of condition that you can't give birth without midwives all over the place, but us Hebrews, we're so strong and fit and out working in the fields that our women are really, you know, pretty healthy. And they give birth like peas coming out of a pod. Nothing to it. Yeah. That was their excuse. And like I say, perhaps it wasn't entirely untrue, but it certainly wasn't, of course, the whole truth. Verse 20. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, they knew his law and were prepared to heed God's law, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So if the midwives weren't going to do it, then as far as Pharaoh is concerned, he'll get the Egyptians to do it. They got to keep their eyes open, look around. When they hear a new baby crying, go and find out, male or female, boy or girl, dressed in blue or pink, and if it's dressed in blue, pick it up and toss it into the Nile. Pharaoh was clearly not a nice man, a hard man, a hard attitude. And of course, this was probably Satan here as well, continuing to try to exterminate, you know, the males of Israel, and thereby try and prevent the birth of the coming Messiah, who would of course be a son, a male, you know, born to somebody in the tribes of Israel. Carrying on then in chapter 2. And a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. I'm not quite sure how beautiful Moses was, but something was particularly attractive about him. It's mentioned several times in the Bible. So something about the young baby that really set him apart in many ways. I'm sure most mothers, perhaps all mothers, think their babies are beautiful. Nothing particularly unusual in that, but perhaps something a little bit special about Moses' appearance. But when she could no longer hide him, remember that the Egyptians were looking for boy babies to toss into the Nile, which they may even have seen as basically sacrificing, because I think they believed the Nile was virtually a god. And if you gave a human sacrifice to the pagan god of the Nile, they probably felt that would get them blessings and so on. And so Moses, being a boy baby, had to be hidden. Keep your eyes open, keep your ears peeled, have the people around your house and your street watching out for Egyptians coming. If any Egyptians are coming nearby, make sure the baby's taken away and hidden somewhere. Really very difficult times. And we can gloss over them quite easily, but life was hard then. And for a mum and a dad with a beautiful baby boy, knowing it could be taken away and killed if spotted, it must have been really quite trying. But when she could no longer hide him, perhaps he's getting noisier now as he's older, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. So the baby's supposed to be thrown into the Nile to drown. Moses was actually put into the Nile in a small, sort of a basket, daubed outside so it wouldn't sort of sink into the water, and put in the rushes, the bulrushes and so on at the side of the Nile. And his sister, verse 4, stood afar off to know what would be done to him. This, we find out later, was Moses' older sister, obviously older because he's a little three-month-old baby, and she's obviously old enough to be down the road and round the corner watching what's taking place. So perhaps she's 5 or 10 years old at this stage. Now it's Miriam, his sister. So his sister Miriam, stood afar off to find out what's going to happen. Then, verse 5, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. Now, was this purely an accident? Obviously not. God had plans, and God was working these plans out. Everything was coming along exactly as God desired and predicted. So along comes, strangely enough, the daughter of Pharaoh to wash just that particular part of the Nile. And the Nile was, to the Egyptians, a sacred river. There was a god of the Nile. And I suppose bathing could be either to keep clean, or perhaps it was a sort of religious ceremony too. You go down and bathe in the holy waters of the Nile. And her maidens walked along the river's side, and when she saw the ark, this little basket, among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. That's unusual, as a little sort of strange wickerwork basket over there among those bulrushes and flowers. I wonder what's in there. And, curiosity. She sent one of her maids to say, "Look, go and fetch that basket. Let's see what's inside it." And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. And I guess that went straight to her heart, this little beautiful baby. And he's crying there in this little cozy basket. So she had compassion on him and said, "Oh, this is one of the Hebrews' children." And she knew the story, and she knew what she was supposed to do. It was her own dad. The Pharaoh had said, any boy baby, you got to throw him into the Nile. And so she should have done that if she went along with her father's commands and demands. But instead, this little beautiful boy, with the tears running down his face, she was moved with compassion. And she said, this is clearly one of the Israelite boys. Verse 7, then his sister, so that's Miriam, said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" That was pretty clever, really. Miriam was quite worldly wise here, quite smart, runs up and says, "Your Highness, would you like me to go and find a suitable Hebrew women who can look after and the child and feed it and change his diapers and so on. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. So it's really quite incredible in a sense. You know, here's Moses being raised by his own mum, and actually his mum's being paid, you know, by the royal court to raise him. So it all worked out extraordinarily well. And of course, this young child would be known, you know, as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, and hence a very special young child, and certainly not one to be thrown into the Nile. So now Moses was safe as a child. He had special privileges as the daughter, or as the son, sorry, of Pharaoh's daughter, and even Moses' mum was being paid probably quite a decent amount of money to raise her own son. Fabulous. Verse 10. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So I guess at some stage, 10 or 15, or a teenager, or whatever, the young child's brought back to Pharaoh's court and becomes officially a member, you know, of the royal court. And, you know, Pharaoh's daughter formally adopts him as her son, gives him her name. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. And now, you know, a few more years pass. Verse 11, and this is now, as we'll find out later, about age 40 for Moses. So he's grown up now. He is a adult, a mature man, highly educated. He's been raised in the court of the Pharaoh. He's learned a great deal about mathematics, about astronomy, about literature, poetry. He's surrounded by great statues and works of art. He's used to living with the luxury and so on, and he's a man who is now you know, a very highly experienced, very influential individual in Pharaoh's court, and he's now about 40 years old. Verse 11. Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. So for another 40 years at least, the oppression has continued upon the people of Israel. It seems quite likely that they'd long since tried or stopped trying to kill all the boy babies. That was something may have lasted for a few months or whatever, but I guess that's died out now. But the oppression continues. Life remains very hard for people who are essentially enslaved. And of course, for those of us before we were called by God, living in this world, there are many people in this world, in this society, for whom life is pretty hard, is violent, they struggle, they have anxieties and concerns, you know, life can be really difficult. And anyway, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. I mean, Moses knew his background. Clearly his mum had told him a great deal about it, and his sister Miriam and so on, and his other older brother Aaron, he probably knew as well. So Moses knew his background on the one hand, but he had these great privileges as an adopted Egyptian on the other hand. But he went out anyway and saw that, was it not right? You know, one of my Hebrew brethren, one of my own nation and tribe, is being beaten up here, you know, by an Egyptian. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So obviously, you know, Moses must have felt that he knew it was right and wrong, and he's going to get involved here and defend this this Hebrew slave from being set upon by this Egyptian who was taking advantage of the position. And so, you know, Moses gets involved. Whether he tried to, you know, remonstrate first of all verbally and say, don't do that, get away, stand back, who knows exactly the details, but ultimately it turned to violence. And Moses was, one imagines, a strong, powerful individual, highly trained in martial arts, and he ended up being the victor and buried the Egyptian in the sand, where he hoped nobody would know about it. And when he went out the second day, a day later, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? This is not the right thing to do. You're brethren. You shouldn't be arguing and coming to fisticuffs. Stop that immediately. Then he said, one of them, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Oh, my word. He thought it was all kept highly confidential. Nobody saw it. The Egyptian was now buried in the sand, just somebody gone missing. But now it seems that, other people know about this. And of course, other people did know about it. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So Moses basically took off, got on the fastest train out of town, and wasn't seen again for 40 odd years. And he headed east of Egypt to the territory of Midian. And if we keep our place there and just turn for a moment to Acts 7, we'll just read a parallel passage. Acts chapter 7, keep your finger there in Exodus though. Acts 7, starting in verse 17. And here we read verse 17 of Acts 7. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. At this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, that would be in the river, in the basket, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. It doesn't tell us a great deal there, but obviously Moses was quite an accomplished individual. It says that he was learned in all the wisdom. So, science, astronomy, mathematics, all of those skills, Moses was highly educated. He was mighty in words and deeds. Josephus, the historian, says that Moses was actually a general in the Egyptian armies and fought a number of conquests and was mighty in battle. Now, I don't think we know whether that's accurate or not, but certainly we're told here that Moses was mighty in words and deeds. He was a very powerful, influential, educated, accomplished person. Verse 23, but when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Verse 24, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. So Moses must have had some idea that he was in Pharaoh's court for a reason, that his youth had been in many ways rather amazing, almost miraculous. And he perhaps felt that as the powerful force within Egypt, perhaps a general in their armies, that he would somehow be able to bring about the liberation and freedom of his people. Of course, he was a bit ahead of his time here. Verse 26, and the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, men, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one another? But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday? Then, at this saying, Moses fled and became a sojourner in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. Okay, so let's go back now to Exodus chapter 2. picking up the story now in verse 15 again. So Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh for quite a distance and dwelt finally in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. So he made his way to the territory of Midian, some miles east of Egypt. And he sits down now by a well, where obviously there's some water, he can relax a bit. Now verse 16, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. So the priest of Midian, who we know later to be Jethro, had perhaps quite a large number of flocks and herds, and also he had quite a big family, seven girls. That would be quite noisy, would have thought. And so the seven girls are coming along here to water their father's flocks. Verse 17, then the shepherds came and drove them away. So, you know, I guess water is always very important and for survival. And, you know, in those days, if you had flocks and herds and sheep and cattle and so on, you would need to water them, and horses and camels. And so here come, you know, Jethro's daughters to water their flocks. As soon as they arrive, these big strapping lads, the shepherds, come in, run them off, because they want the water, and they're going to have it first. And when we're finished, perhaps, ladies, you can come back and get what's left. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. That's rather brief. You know, Moses stood up and helped them. Well, how do you do that? You know, if there's a number of big, you know, rough, tough shepherds there, they're running these girls off, and Moses stands up and helps them, it rather implies that Moses is quite a big strapping man himself, if he can put several shepherds to flight and look after the girls. So either by his intimidating personality and his air of importance and authority, or else by sheer dint of his physical power, Moses does a decent thing and comes to the rescue of these girls. Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock, which allowed them to, you know, finish earlier than usual and go back home. Verse 18, when they came to Reuel, also known as Jethro, their father, he said, how is it that you have come so soon today? You know, you girls are early. How come? And they said, an Egyptian. Because don't forget, you know, Moses would be dressed like an Egyptian with Egyptian clothing on. He probably spoke the Egyptian language. And as far as they're concerned, this guy who helped us is an Egyptian. An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock. I mean, fair enough, you know, Moses was outgoing here. You know, he worked a bit, and he helped them and did some tasks for them, and he looked after the ladies. He wasn't, I guess, you know, a male chauvinist that sat back and said, well, you water the flock and then bring me some water when you're good and ready, will you, girls? You know, Moses took the initiative, he got the water, he watered the animals, helped the ladies out, and then I guess, you know, he relaxed. So he, Jethro of Reuel, said to his daughters, and where is he? You know, why is it that you've left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread. It does seem, from reading, you know, many parts of the Old Testament, that looking after strangers, being kind to people who are passing through your territory, and being courteous and polite and outgoing was really the very strong custom. So here's Jethro saying, well, hang on a moment, girls. This guy's he's delivered you from the shepherds. He's looked after you. How come he's not with you? Where is the man? You know, bring him here. We need to feed this guy and look after him and show him a very good welcome. That's not right to do otherwise. And so, you know, Moses arrived, and the story carries on rather rapidly. And then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. Excuse me. So one assumes that several months, perhaps a year or whatever, had passed here, and, you know, Moses got to know the family, they got to know him, and after, you know, time had elapsed, you know, Zipporah was batting her eyelashes at Moses, and Moses thought she was very attractive, and eventually, you know, Jethro gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Moses had two sons by Zipporah. Gershom was the firstborn, and then I think Eliezer, I think we come across him later. Verse 23, Now, it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. You know, another number of years have passed, perhaps 10 or 20 or 30 years have passed by now, and the hard guy, the one who was causing so much of the trouble, has now died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked down upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. So even though the king had died in Egypt, the oppression, the misery continued. Life was hard, you know, for another number of years. Moving on now to chapter 3. Verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. So, you know, Moses was undertaking a fairly basic task. He had been there in the royal courts, looked up to and respected, and enjoying a life of luxury and wealth, and perhaps a general in the army, perhaps not, but certainly a man who'd enjoyed some of the finest that life had to offer. And now, here he was many decades later, and what's he doing? He's out in the fields looking after, not even his own sheep, it says here, he's looking after, you know, Jethro's sheep. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And we'll see later, I think, that Horeb is otherwise known as Mount Sinai, you know, the mountain of God. There are some questions about, you know, where exactly Mount Sinai is. If you look in most Bible maps, you'll find it down in the so-called Sinai Peninsula, which is you know, the very bottom of that triangular part. But there are a number of people who've got very good reason for saying that, no, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, the traditional site, is actually the wrong one, that it's not there at all. The real Mount Sinai, the real Mount Horeb, is across the Gulf of Aqaba, and is in what is today Saudi Arabia. And there are some disputes as to where it could be, and I guess ultimately it may not be too important. But if we just turn briefly to, where is it? Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4. Starting in verse 24. Galatians 4, verse 24. Paul's explaining something to the brethren in Galatia. He says, for these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. So interestingly, in a sense, you know, Paul says that Mount Sinai is in Arabia. And again, you know, people debate and dispute, but certainly there's some quite strong and persuasive evidence to show that the real Mount Sinai is not the one that we find in our maps in our Bibles, and that the real Mount Sinai is in what is today, you know, Saudi Arabia. But anyway, carrying on, verse 2. And the angel of the Eternal appeared to him, Moses, in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he, Moses, looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, which might not be too unusual. You know, you're out in the, you know, the wilderness areas, and there's lots of bushes, and occasionally, you know, the lightning might strike and so on, or the sunshine might be very hot and occasionally set fire to a bush. So perhaps burning bushes weren't too too amazing. But a bush that burned and burned and burned and burned and kept on burning and burning but didn't actually burn up, now that would be unusual. But the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, well, that's curious. I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why the bush does not burn or does not burn up? And you and I think, would be equally curious. I mean, we could imagine seeing a, you know, bush burning somewhere and thinking, well, I've been burning for about an hour now. How come it's, you know, I still see leaves on it as well? They should be gone by now. And I was going to wander over and just have a closer look at this strange thing. So when the Eternal saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Probably thinking, hello, what's this? And then God said, do not draw near this place. I think Moses was carrying on, heading for it. And it says, stop, Moses, hold on there. Don't come any nearer. Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. And I think we'll remember that Mr. Armstrong used to use this illustration when talking about keeping the Sabbath holy. And what made the ground holy here? I mean, ground, earth and roots and weeds and a few bushes. Nothing holy about that. But the ground was holy because God was present there, in and around that area. That's what made the ground holy. So, Moses, get your shoes off. This ground is holy because I'm here. And Mr. Armstrong said, well, in a sense, that's what makes Saturday holy. God is present in the Sabbath day. From sunset on Friday to sunset on a Saturday night, God puts his presence especially on that day to bless it and sanctify it. And just like Moses had to treat this ground with respect, you and I have got to treat the Sabbath with respect. It's holy time. It's a holy day to God. Verse 6. Moreover, God said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. So Moses realized something very special is happening here. The God of my fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is talking to me here in the wilderness out of a burning bush. Oh, my word. Verse 7. And the Eternal said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and a large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. A land where there's so much pasture and grass and greenery that there's cattle and goats all over the place, bees, and among all the flowers and the bushes and, honeycombs. The land is just a land that is so abundant and so beautiful, so rich with agricultural delights, to the place currently of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now therefore. Here comes the news that Moses may or may not have been expecting or waiting for. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, when we read Acts earlier, it did suggest that when Moses was 40, he thought that he would be the guy to deliver them. And he was most concerned that the Israelites didn't understand that he was going to be their great deliverer. But now that 40 years has passed, Moses perhaps is a rather a different attitude. Perhaps he's no longer the very almost arrogant, powerful, influential man of the court, the possible army general, the guy with the vim and the vigor to go out and do things. For the last 40 years, he's been looking after sheep, no longer engaging in intellectual discourses with the wise men of Egypt, the poetry, and now he's been just used to bah, 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 all day long, day and night, for the best part of 40 years. And Moses has now got a different opinion, perhaps, of himself. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Me? And so God said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Here, at Mount Sinai, at Mount Horeb, in Midian, in Arabia, you're going to bring them over here. And then Moses said to God, well, just a minute. Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what's his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, the eternal God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the eternal God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Then, God continues, they will heed your voice, and you shall come, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, the eternal God of the Hebrews has met with us, and now please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the eternal our God. But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. You know, God knew what was coming. He was able to read, you know, Pharaoh's attitude, mind, and temperament pretty easily, I guess. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in his midst. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor, in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be, when you go, that you shall not go empty-handed. You're not just going to walk out of Egypt with the clothes on your back. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely, of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So you shall plunder the Egyptians. And if you think about it, for decades, the Israelites had served the Egyptians for nothing. They were slave people. They were given perhaps enough to eat, and perhaps not much more than that, clothes to live in and homes to dwell in, and that was probably the lot. So for decades, the Egyptians had used the entire Israelite nation without paying them any decent wages. So God's saying, look, you know, when you leave, you are going to demand of the Egyptians silver and gold and fine clothing and so on. It's going to be really, in essence, back wages. I think the King James Version says you're going to borrow these items. Well, of course, they're not borrowed because they weren't going to be paid back. And that's just a poor translation. The idea was that you're going to get all this back pay, and then you're going to leave Egypt with enough to keep you comfortable. Chapter 4. Then Moses, he wasn't finished debating with God yet. He had certainly lost some of his earlier enthusiasm as a younger man of a mere 40. He's now 80 years old and perhaps thinking about drawing his pension. Then Moses answered and said, but suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say the Eternal has not appeared to you, which was quite likely. And the Eternal said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, it's a rod. He said, cast it on the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it, which I think I would do too. You mean, carting this stick all over the desert for perhaps a number of years, it's your trusty old, staff, your trusty old, sort of shepherd's crook, and you've used it time and time again for perhaps months or years. And then God says, yeah, throw your stick in the ground, and you throw your stick in the ground, and it turns into perhaps a highly poisonous cobra and starts hissing at you. Well, no wonder Moses took off. Verse 4. Then the Eternal said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. Okay, I'll think about that. And he reached out his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. This, that they may believe that the Eternal God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. There's a sign you can do, Moses. If they, you know, don't believe you, take this shepherd's rod, toss it in the ground, and I think they'll find out that's rather impressive. Verse 6. Furthermore, the Eternal said to him, Now put your hand in your bosom, you know, inside your jacket. And he put his hand in his bosom. When he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, like snow. The skin had all covered in some, you know, white, horrible scales. You know, leprosy in just, you know, just an instant. And he said, put your hand in your jacket again. He put his hand in his bosom again and drew it out of his bosom, and behold, it was restored like his other flesh. Then it will be, if they do not believe you, nor heed the message of the first sign, that they may believe the message of the latter sign. And it shall be, if they do not believe even these two signs, or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river, that would be the Nile, and pour it on the dry land. And the water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. That'll be another miracle to impress them. And you might have thought, well, Moses should be pretty confident by now. You know, God's going to go with him. God's going to work miracles through him. God's going to help him to release you know, his brethren from captivity and slavery. But Moses isn't finished yet, trying to back off. Then Moses said to the Eternal, oh, my Lord, I can't speak. I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you've spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. You know, perhaps 40 years looking after sheep, he'd lost the ability to be fluent and eloquent and mighty in word, or perhaps he'd developed some sort of a speech impediment. Who knows? It shouldn't have made much difference. The Eternal said to him, well, hang on a second, who made man's mouth? Who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, the blind? Have not I, the Eternal? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. You know, don't worry about any minor impediments, Moses. Look, I, you know, God Almighty, El Shaddai, I'm going with you. I'll tell you exactly what to say, and it'll be effective. You know, with you and me together, we're a majority. You can perhaps think of the Apostle Paul writing in Philippians. He said, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. You know, Paul had developed that that faith, and the Apostle Paul knew that no matter what it was, with Christ strengthening him, giving him the power, he could go and do it. But Moses was finding, you know, more and more reasons why, well, not me, you see, well, they won't believe me, you see, and it's too far to go, and you know, I can't speak very well. Verse 13, Moses said, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Choose somebody else. Basically, God, thanks for the offer, but try and find another person for it. So the anger of the Eternal was kindled against Moses. You know, up till now, Moses had been perhaps being shown rather as a humble man, not arrogant any longer, conscious of his own weaknesses, but God keeps saying, go on, you can do it. I'm going to be with you. I'll give you the power. I'll work miracles through you. And eventually, it becomes not just humbleness on Moses' part, becomes now stubbornness and rebellion. Okay, God, thanks a lot for thinking of me, but you can find somebody else in another part of the country. Go on, run along now. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. He's a big mouth, perhaps. And look, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Well, you know, God's already, in a sense, aware of what's likely to happen with Moses, and already he's commissioned Aaron to head out of Egypt across towards Midian. Aaron, who is 3 years older than Moses, so he'll be about 83 at this stage, is making his way, you know, across the territory towards where Moses is. And he's going to be happy when he sees you. I mean, you might have thought that, you know, Aaron being the senior, the elder, might be rather jealous that God's going to commission his younger brother Moses. But not really. You know, Aaron is quite happy, quite delighted to see his younger brother after, you know, an absence of, what, 40-odd years? Verse 15. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. And you shall take this rod in your hand, with which you shall do these signs. So, okay, you're whinging about your inability to speak fluently, Moses. Your brother's on his way. He's got a great ability with his tongue and his mouth. So you simply pass on the message to him, and we'll use him to pass it on to the Egyptians. I mean, this was really not, should have been necessary, really. I mean, God could clearly work through Moses if Moses had been a bit more willing to cooperate. But God, you know, okay, accepts eventually all Moses' complaints and does it Moses' way. And of course, you know, in some ways, you know, Aaron turned out to be probably quite helpful in carrying these messages. But I think in later chapters, later books, we find out that Aaron brought some problems too, didn't he? The incident with the golden calf, you know, wasn't Aaron highly responsible there? There was a time when Aaron and Miriam rebelled, you know, against Moses. So there were some problems in store with his older brother here. Verse 18. So Moses went, having been, if you like, finally convinced, and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go and return to my brethren who are in Egypt, and see whether they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." So you can understand that Moses was actually in many ways, you know, employed by Jethro, looking after Jethro's flock. So he's not just going to walk off and say, "Well, God commissioned me, so I'm just going to clear off and ignore my responsibilities." He goes back and says, "You know, Jethro, you know, I've got to make a long journey for various reasons, and you know, I'd just like to leave you amicably and let you organize somebody else to look after your sheep." So it's all done, you know, decently and in order. And the Eternal said to Moses and Midian, "Go, return to Egypt, for all the men are dead who sought your life," which of course was 40 years earlier. Then Moses took his wife, you know, Zipporah, and his sons, plural, there being two of them, and set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. So off he goes, making his way back. Verse 21. And the Eternal said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your heart." You know, don't go chicken on me, Moses. When you get there, remember why you're there. "But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." In reality, of course, this Pharaoh was a pretty stubborn beast in the first place and didn't take much to let his heart get hardened. "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Eternal, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" And that was a message that Moses was to take. Not exactly an easy message to go to the Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world at that time, who could have your head chopped off in a moment or two, and bring him what was clearly going to be, you know, not very welcome news. Verse 24. "And it came to pass on the way at the encampment," which might have been an inn of some sort, or some place you would stop en route on long journeys, "that the Eternal met him and sought to kill him." Now, the commentators are all very confused as to exactly who God was seeking to kill here. Was it to kill Moses or to kill one of Moses' sons? It turns out one son had not been circumcised. You know, bearing in mind that here was Moses, you know, representing the covenant God to bring the people of the covenant out of slavery in Egypt. It turns out that one of Moses' two sons doesn't even have the seal or the sign of the covenant. So there was clearly an issue of some sort here. So God met him and sought to kill him, whoever the him might be. "Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, 'Surely you are a husband of blood to me.' So he," God, "let him go." And then she said, "You're a husband of blood because of the circumcision." So for whatever reason, one of Moses' two sons had not been circumcised. I think the suspicion is that perhaps Zipporah didn't like circumcision of her first son, kicked up a stink when Moses wanted to do it, perhaps the second son, and then Moses perhaps yielded to the voice of his wife, to her persuasion, and didn't do it. And so here he is off to rescue and deliver the people of the covenant, and there's a problem in his own immediate family. Verse 27. "And the Eternal said to Aaron," or had said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." So he went and met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. So Moses told Aaron all the words of the Eternal who had sent him, and all the signs which he had commanded him. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Eternal had spoken to Moses, because remember, Aaron is now the spokesman on behalf of Moses, because Moses reckons he can't talk proper. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. So one imagines they didn't quite believe him, so out come the miracles, and all of a sudden, oh, that's all rather impressive. Verse 31. So the people believed when they saw the evidence, and when they heard that the Eternal had visited the children of Israel, and that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped, because now this looks like, at long last, you know, good news. After all these decades of slavery, oppression, the young boy's been thrown into the river Nile and so on, more oppression even after a change of king and so on, now they hear that good news is approaching. God Almighty is going to deliver you and bring you to a land which is abundant and prosperous, and you'll be your own people, no more slaves. Fantastic. And so they bowed their heads and worshipped. Chapter 5. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh. So, here they are. The big day comes. Got to now go and eyeball the Pharaoh and tell him some of the facts of life. Thus says the Eternal God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh said, who is the Eternal, that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? Because Pharaoh, as far as he's concerned, there's thousands of gods. Lots of gods of Egypt, and gods of Assyria, and gods of Syria, and gods of Africa, and gods of whatever. There's gods of the beetles, and gods of the Nile, and gods of the moon and the sun. Who is, you know, this God, Moses, this Jehovah? Who is Jehovah? That I should obey his voice? He's nothing to me. I mean, I'm not interested in your Hebrew gods. I do not know the Eternal, nor, incidentally, Moses, will I let Israel go. Because, of course, you know, the Israelites were hugely important economically for the Egyptians. They did all the work. You know, we're sort of a slave people, cheap labor, and so on. No way, Moses, are they going to leave this country. Verse 3, so they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, you know, being polite at this point, please, let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Eternal our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. Then the king of Egypt said to them, Moses, Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. And one imagines that perhaps not far behind Moses and Aaron were the elders that all come perhaps, you know, as one big group to see the Pharaoh. You know, Moses and Aaron perhaps at the front, Aaron doing the talking, and perhaps the elders, however many there were, a few yards behind. And Pharaoh says, look, you shouldn't be here. There's work to be done. Verse 5, and Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And up till this point, it seems that the Egyptians had provided the straw and the sheaves and so on to help in the brick making. But now the Pharaoh is a bit annoyed. You know, the cheek of these Israelites. You know, they get too much time on their hands. Time to go out and get their own straw in future to make bricks. Verse 8, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. Even though they've now got to go and gather their own raw materials, and it'll take a long time, no way are they to do any less than before. You shall not diminish it, for they are idle. No, they're lazy, these Israelites. Therefore they cry out, saying, let us go sacrifice to our God. You know, they get too much time on their hands. Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. You know, listen to Moses with these silly ideas. Just give them more work to do. Make life even harder for them. And the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. You've had it. You know, I'm fed up with you. Go, get yourselves straw where you can find it. Yet, none of your work will be diminished. So the people were scattered abroad throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble instead of straw. You had to go, you know, over there, up in the hills, down the valleys, hunting out all the bits and pieces of stubble and cut pieces of, you know, barley and corn and whatnot to make their own raw material for Brinks. And the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, "Fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw." Also, the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not fulfilled your task in making brick both yesterday and today as before? You're falling down. You know, you're not delivering the number you should do. You failed," you know, and they beat them up. Verse 15, then the officers of the children of Israel, the sort of higher up ones who were like superintendents, came and cried out to Pharaoh saying, "You know, why are you dealing thus with your servants? There's no straw given to your servants," that's to us. "And they say to us, make brick. And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." You know, you're quite annoyed with the Pharaoh. You know, you're telling us to keep making bricks and beating us up. You're not giving us the materials. It's your fault, Pharaoh. It's your people's fault, not our fault. We can't do any more. Verse 17, but Pharaoh said, you're idle, you're bone lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Eternal. Therefore, go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the full quota of bricks, not one less. And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble, after it was said, you shall not diminish any bricks from your daily quota. Then, as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, let the Lord look on you and judge, meaning basically, you know, God curse you, you pair. Let the Eternal look on you and judge or punish, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. You make us stink, you know, in their sight. And it's all your fault, you know, Moses, and yours, Aaron. You know, disgusting what you've done. So Moses and Aaron weren't exactly flavor of the month with the officers. Verse 22. So Moses returned to the Eternal and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you've sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. You know, Moses was getting a bit puzzled. Well, you've commissioned me. You know, I've come, God. I've taken the message to Pharaoh. I've done what you said. But you haven't delivered the people yet. In fact, his life's even harder for them. And so, you know, Moses was just a little bit puzzled. But you know, it was plain speech. You know, Moses wasn't beating about the bush here. And I guess God was fairly content that Moses brought this to him. But of course, Moses didn't have the big picture. There's a lot more to happen yet before the people could go. And God was working things out, you know, exactly as required, you know, bit by bit. And we just have time to get chapter 6 done, just about, I think. It's not too long, is it? Not too long. Then the Eternal said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Eternal, or I am Jehovah. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, or I appeared as El Shaddai, which is the Hebrew there. But by my name, Eternal, or Jehovah, I was not known to them. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, in which they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. You know, God had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that the land of Canaan would be available to their descendants to live in and prosper in. And God remembered that and was about now to bring it to pass. Therefore, verse 6, say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from the bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Eternal, your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. and I will bring you into the land which I swore, or promised, to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Eternal. So there's a number of promises there. I will do this, I will do this, I will do this, I will do this. Many, many promises. And it should have been very encouraging. Verse 9, so Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel. But they would not heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. And their life had become just too much for them. They had now lost heart. They couldn't listen to Moses. They had no confidence. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, go in, speak to the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he must let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moses spoke before the Eternal, saying, the children of Israel have not heeded me. You know, they won't pay any attention to me, and I'm one of them. How then shall Pharaoh heed me? For I am of uncircumcised lips. I'm a poor speaker, as you know, God, I've told you before. You know, these people are ignoring me. You think Pharaoh's going to pay any attention? You know, come on, God. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a command or a charge for the children of Israel and for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. He just said, look, Moses, these are orders. Get on with it. And there's a slight insert for the next sort of dozen verses or so. The story stops for a moment because it's just a question of now just proving, if you like, that Moses and Aaron were the right men for the job. So a short genealogy follows the next few verses, just identifying really that Moses and Aaron were actually, you know, good guys from the right part of Israel, that Abraham was indeed their father. So verse 14, these are the heads of their father's houses. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, were Hanok and Palu, Hezron and Carmi. These are the families of Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn and son of Leah. And the sons of Simeon, who was also son of Leah, were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the families of Simeon. And so Reuben and Simeon were both sons of Leah. And her third son was Levi. These are the names of the sons of Levi. So it's just Leah's three sons who are being identified here, basically to get to Levi. He's the important one in this connection. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations. Gershon, Kohath, Merari. And the years of the life of Levi were 137, a good age. Of course, Moses himself lived to be 120, and when he finally was put down, so to speak, his eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. But he had some, you know, good parents and grandparents. The sons of Gershon were Libni and Shimi, according to their families. And the sons of Kohath were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. And the years of the life of Kohath were 133. The sons of Merari were Mahali and Mushi. These are the families of Levi according to their generations. Now Amram took for himself Jochebed, his father's sister, as wife. That would be his aunt. And she bore him Aaron and Moses. And the years of the life of Amram were 137. So I've got some little coloured rings in my Bible around Levi, and a line taking it to Kohath, who was Levi's son, from Kohath to Amram, who was Kohath's son, from Amram, of course, to Aaron and Moses. So Levi's son was Kohath, grandson was Amram, and great-grandsons were Aaron and Moses. So only a couple of three generations down from Levi himself. So we know here that Aaron and Moses' mum and dad were Amram and Jochebed. Verse 21, the sons of Izhar were Korah, Nepheg, and Zikri. Sons of Uziel were Mishael, Elzaphan, and Zithri. Aaron took to himself Elisheba, daughter of Aminadab, sister of Nashon, as wife, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And the sons of Korah were Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph. These are the families of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took for himself one of the daughters of Putiel as wife, and she bore him Phinehas. He became famous a bit later on. These are the heads of the fathers of the Levites according to their families. These are the same Aaron and Moses to whom the Eternal said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. These are the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. And these are the same Moses and Aaron. In the Western world today, we think this is rather unnecessary to go through all the same information about Moses and Aaron. But I think in those days, identifying your family line, who was your dad and your granddad and your great-granddad, was all very important. So it's rather clear here that we know exactly who Moses and Aaron are and exactly their part in the genealogy. Verse 28, and it came to pass on the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, I am the Eternal. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said before the Eternal, behold, you know, never gives up, does he, Moses? I'm a man of uncircumcised lips. How shall Pharaoh heed me? And at that point, before he goes to the Pharaoh to deliver some even more bad news, so to speak, I guess we run out of time for this week. But it's a good start, chapters 1 to 6. There's only 40 chapters altogether, so hopefully we'll finish the entire book round about the time of the Passover, or hopefully thereabouts. So that's a good start, and we'll pick up next time with chapter 7 of the book of Exodus.